Chapter 4. The drum rolled and thundered at the Sophie's hatchway. Feet came racing up from below, a desperate rushing sound that made even the tense drumbeat seem more urgent. But apart from the landman's in the new draft, the men's faces were calm, for this was beating to quarters, an afternoon ritual that many of the crew had performed some 2,000 or 3,000 times, each running to a particular place by one allotted gun or to a given set of ropes that he knew by heart. No one could have called this a creditable performance, however. Much had been changed in the Sophie's comfortable old routine. The manning of the guns was different. A score of worried, sheep-like landmen had to be pushed and pulled into something like the right place. And since most of the newcomers could not yet be allowed to do anything more than heave under guidance, the sloop's waist was so crowded that men trampled upon one another's toes. 10 minutes passed while the Sophie's people seethed about her upper deck and her fighting tops. Jack stood watching placidly abaft the wheel, while Dylan barked orders, and the warrant officers and midshipmen darted furiously about, aware of their captain's gaze and conscious that their anxiety was not improving anything at all. Jack had expected something of a shambles, though not anything quite so unholy as this, but his native good humour and the delight of feeling even the inept stirring of this machine under his control overcame all other, more righteous emotions. "Why do they do this?" asked Stephen at his elbow. "Why do they run about so earnestly?" "The idea is that every man shall know exactly where to go in action, in an emergency," said Jack. "It would never do if they had to stand pondering. The gun teams are there at their stations already, you see, and so are Sergeant Quinn's marines here. The forecastle men are all there, as far as I can make out, and I dare say the waisters will be in order presently. A captain to each gun, do you see, and a sponger and boarder next to him, the man with the belt and cutlass. They join the boarding party, and a sail trimmer, who leaves the gun if we have to brace the yards round, for example, in action, and a fireman, the one with the bucket. His task is to dash out any fire that may start. Now, there's Pullings, reporting his division ready to Dylan. We shall not be long now." There were plenty of people on the little quarter-deck. The master at the con, the quartermaster at the wheel, the marine sergeant and his small-arms party, the signal midshipman, part of the afterguard, the gun crews, James Dillon, the clerk, and still others. But Jack and Stephen paced up and down as though they were alone. Jack enveloped in the Olympian majesty of a captain, and Stephen caught up within his aura. It was natural enough to Jack, who had known this state of affairs since he was a child, but it was the first time that Stephen had met with it, and it gave him a not altogether disagreeable sensation of waking death. Either the absorbed, attentive men on the other side of the glass wall were dead, mere phantasmata, or he was, though in that case it was a strange little death, for although he was used to this sense of isolation, of being a colourless shade in a silent private underworld, he now had a companion, an audible companion. Your station, for example, would be below, in what we call the cockpit. Not that it is a real cockpit, any more than that forecastle's a real forecastle in the sense of being raised, but we call it the cockpit, with the midshipman's sea chests as your operating table and your instruments all ready. Is that where I should live? No, no, we shall fix you up with something better than that. Even when you come under the Articles of War, said Jack with a smile, you'll find that we still honour learning, at least to the extent of 10 square feet of privacy and as much fresh air on the quarter-deck as you may choose to breathe in. Stephen nodded. Tell me, he said in a low voice, some moments later. Were I under naval discipline, could that fellow have me whipped? He nodded towards Mr. Marshall. The master? Cried Jack with inexpressible amazement. Yes, said Stephen, looking attentively at him with his head slightly inclined to the left. But he's the master, said Jack. If Stephen had called the Sophie's stem her stern, or her truck her keel, he would have understood the situation directly. But that Stephen should confuse the chain of command, the relative status of a captain and a master, of a commissioned officer and a warrant officer, so subverted the natural order, so undermined the sempiternal universe, that for a moment his mind could hardly encompass it. Yet Jack, though no great scholar, no judge of a hexameter, was tolerably quick, and after gasping no more than twice, he said, "My dear sir, I believe you've been led astray by the words master and master and commander. Illogical terms, I must confess. The first is subordinate to the second. You must allow me to explain our naval ranks sometime, but in any case you will never be flogged. No, no, you shall not be flogged," he added, gazing with pure affection and with something like awe at so magnificent a prodigy, at an ignorance so very far beyond anything that even his wide-ranging mind had yet conceived. James Dillon broke through the glass wall. "Hands at quarter, sir, if you please," he said, raising his three-corner hat. "Very well, Mr. Dillon," said Jack. "We will exercise the great guns." A four-pounder may not throw a very great weight of metal, and it may not be able to pierce 2 feet of oak half a mile away, as a 32-pounder can, but it does throw a solid 3-inch cast-iron ball at 1,000 feet a second, which is an ugly thing to receive. And the gun itself is a formidable machine. Its barrel is 6 feet long. It weighs 1,200 weight. It stands on a ponderous oak carriage. And when it is fired, it leaps back as though it were violently alive. The Sophie possessed 14 of these, 7 aside. And the 2 aftermost guns on the quarterdeck were gleaming brass. Each gun had a crew of 4, and a man or boy to bring up powder from the magazine. Each group of guns was in charge of a midshipman or a master's mate. Pullings had the 6 forward guns, Ricketts the 4 in the waist, and Babington the 4 farthest aft. "Mr. Babington, where is this gun's powder horn?" asked Jack coldly. "I don't know, sir," stammered Babington, very red. "It seems to have gone astray." "Quarter gunner," said Jack, "go to Mr. Day, no, to his mate, for he's sick, and get another." His inspection showed no other obvious shortcomings, but when he had had both broadsides run in and out 6 times, that is to say, when the men had been through all the motions short of actually firing the guns, his face grew long and grave. They were quite extraordinarily slow. They had obviously been trained to fire nothing but whole broadsides at once, very little independent firing. They seemed quite happy with easing their guns gently up to the port at the rate of the slowest of them all, and the whole exercise had an artificial wooden air. It was true that ordinary convoy duty in a sloop didn't give the men any very passionate conviction of the gun's vital reality, but even so, how I wish I could afford a few barrels of powder, he thought, with a clear image of the gunner's accounts in his mind. 49 half-barrels in all, 7 under the Sophie's full allowance, 41 of them red, large grain, 7 of them white, large grain, restored powder of doubtful strength, and 1 barrel of fine grain for priming. The barrels held 45 pounds. So the Sophie would nearly empty one with each double broadside. "But even so," he went on, "I think we can have a couple of rounds. God knows how long these charges have been lying in the guns. Besides," he added in a voice within his inner voice, a voice from a far deeper level, "think of the lovely smell." "Very well," he said aloud. "Mr. Mowat, be so good as to go into my cabin." Sit down by the table watch and take exact note of the time that elapses between the first and second discharge of each gun. Mr. Pullings, we'll start with your division. Number one. Silence fore and aft. Dead silence fell over the Sophie. The wind sang evenly in her taut weather rigging, steady at 2 points abaft the beam. Number one's crew licked their lips nervously. Their gun was in its ordinary position of rest, bowsed up tight against its port and lashed there, put away, as it were. "Cast loose your gun." They cast loose the tackles that held the gun hard against the side, and cut the spun-yarn frapping that clenched the breeching to hold it firmer still. With a gentle squeal of trucks, the gun showed that it was free. A man held each side tackle, or the Sophie's heel, which made the rear tackle unnecessary, would have brought the gun inboard before the next word of command. "Level your gun." The sponger pushed his handspike under the thick breech of the gun, and with a quick heave levered it up, while number one's captain thrust the wooden wedge more than halfway under, bringing the barrel to the horizontal point-blank position. "Out, Trompion." They let the gun run in fast. The breeching checked its inward course when the muzzle was a foot or so inboard. The sail trimmer whipped out the carved and painted Trompion that plugged it. "Run out your gun." Clapping onto the side tackles, they heaved her up hand over hand, running the carriage hard against the side and coiling the falls, coiling them down in wonderfully neat little fakes. "Prime." The captain took his priming iron, thrust it down the touch hole, and pierced the flannel cartridge lying within the gun, poured fine powder from his horn into the open vent and onto the pan, bruising it industriously with the nozzle. The sponger put the flat of his hand over the powder to prevent its blowing away, and the fireman slung the horn behind his back. "Point your gun." And to this order Jack added, "As she lies," since he wished to add no complications of traversing or elevating for range at this stage. Two of the gun's crew were now holding the side tackles. The sponger knelt on one side with his head away from the gun, blowing gently on the smouldering slow match he had taken from its little tub, for the Sophie didn't run to flint logs. The powder boy stood with the next cartridge in its leather box over on the starboard side directly behind the gun. The captain, holding his vent bit and sheltering the priming, bent over the gun, staring along its barrel. "Fire!" The slow match whipped across. The captain stubbed it hard down onto the priming. For an infinitesimal spark of time there was a hissing, a flash, and then the gun went off with the round, satisfying bang of a pound and more of hard-rammed powder exploding in a confined space. A stab of crimson flame in the smoke, flying morsels of wad, the gun shooting 8 feet backwards under the arched body of its captain and between the members of its crew, the deep twang of the breaching as it brought up the recoil, all these were virtually inseparable in time. And before they were over, the next order came. "Stop your vent," cried Jack, watching for the flight of the ball, as the white smoke raced streaming down to leeward. The captain stabbed his vent piece into the touch hole, and the ball sent up a fleeting plume in the choppy sea 400 yards to windward, then another and another, ducks and drakes for 50 yards before it sank. The crew clapped onto the rear tackle to hold the gun firmly inboard against the roll. "Sponge your gun." The sponger darted his sheepskin swab into the fireman's bucket, and pushing his face into the narrow space between the muzzle and the side, he shot the handle out of the port and thrust the swab down the bore of the gun. He twirled it conscientiously and brought it out, blackened with a little smoking rag on it. "Load with cartridge." The powder boy had the tight cloth bag there ready. The sponger entered it and rammed it hard down. The captain, with his priming iron in the vent to feel for its arrival, cried, "Home! Shot your gun." The ball was there to hand in its garland, and the wad in its cheese. But an unlucky slip sent the ball trundling across the deck towards the forehatch, with the anxious captain, Sponger and Powder Boy following its erratic course. Eventually, it joined the cartridge, with the wad rammed down over it, and Jack cried, "Run out your gun! Prime! Point your gun! Fire! Mr. Mowat!" he called through the cabin skylight. "What was the interval?" 3 minutes and 3/4, sir." Oh, dear," said Jack, almost to himself. There were no words in the vocabulary at his command to express his distress. Pulling's division looked apprehensive and ashamed. Number 3 gun crew had stripped to the waist and had tied their handkerchiefs round their heads against the flash and the thunder. They were spitting on their hands, and Mr. Pullings himself was fussing anxiously about with the crows, handspikes and swabs. "Silence! Cast loose your gun! Level your gun! Out, Tompion! Run out your gun!" This time it was rather better. Just over 3 minutes. But then they'd not dropped their shot, and Mr. Pullings had helped run up the gun and haul on the rear tackle, gazing absently into the sky as he did so, to prove that he was not in fact there at all. As the firing came aft, gun by gun, so Jack's melancholy increased. 1 and 3 had not been unlucky bands of boobies. This was the Sophie's true average rate of fire. Archaic. Antediluvian. And if there had been any question of aiming, of traversing the guns, heaving them round with crows and handspikes, it would have been even slower. Number 5 wouldn't fire, damp having got at the powder, and the gun had to be wormed and drawn. That could happen in any ship, but it was a pity that it also occurred twice in the starboard broadside. The Sophie had come up into the wind to fire her starboard guns, out of a certain delicacy about shooting at random into her convoy, and she was lying there, pitching easily, with almost no way on her, while the last damp charge was being extracted, when Stephen, feeling that in this lull he might without impropriety address the captain, said to Jack, "Pray tell me why those ships are so very close together. Are they conversing, rendering one another mutual assistance?" He pointed over the neat wall of hammocks in the quarter-netting. Jack followed his finger and gazed for an unbelieving second at the rearmost vessel in his convoy, the daughter Engelbrektsdatter, the Norwegian Cat. "Hands to the braces," he shouted. "Port your helm flat in for a jump to it. Brail up the mainsail." Slowly, then faster and faster, with all the wind in her sharp-braced headsails, the Sophie paid off. Now the wind was on her port beam. A few moments later she was right before it, and in still another moment she steadied on her course with the wind 3 points on her starboard quarter. There had been a good deal of trampling to and fro, with Mr. Watt and his mates roaring and piping like fury, but the Sophies were better hands with a sail than a gun, and quite soon Jack could cry, "Square mainsails! Topmast stunsails! Mr. Watt, the top chains and pudding. But I needn't tell you what to do, I see." "Aye, aye, sir," said the boatswain, clanking away aloft, already loaded with the chains that were to prevent the yards falling in action. "Mowat, run up with a glass and tell me what you see. Mr. Dillon, you'll not forget that lookout. We'll have the hide off him tomorrow if he lives to see it. Mr. Lamb, you have your shot plugs ready?" "Ready, aye, ready, sir," said the carpenter, smiling, for this was not a serious question. "Deck!" hailed Mowat, high above the taut, straining canvas. "Deck! She's an Algerine. A quarter galley. They've boarded the Cat. They haven't carried her yet. I think the Norwegians are holding out in their close quarters." "Anything to windward!" called Jack. In the pause that followed, the peevish crackling of pistols could be heard from the Norwegian, struggling faintly up through the streaming of the wind. "Yes, sir, a sail. A lateen. hull down in the wind's eye. I can't make her out for sure. Standing east, standing due east, I think. Jack nodded, looking up and down his two broadsides. He was a big man at any time, but now he seemed to be at least twice his usual size. His eyes were shining in an extraordinary manner, as blue as the sea, and a continuous smile showed a gleam across the lively scarlet of his face. Something of the same change had come over the Sophie, with her big new square mainsail and her topsails immensely broadened by the studding sails at either side of them. She, like her master and commander, seemed to have doubled in size as she tore heavily through the sea. "Well, Mr. Dillon," he cried, "this is a bit of luck, is it not?" Stephen, looking at them curiously, saw that the same extraordinary animation had seized upon James Dillon. Indeed, the whole crew was filled with a strange ebullience. Close by him, the marines were checking the flints of their muskets, and one of them was polishing the buckle of his cross-belt, breathing on it and laughing happily between the carefully directed breaths. "Yes, sir," said James Dillon. "It couldn't have fallen more happily." "Signal the convoy to haul 2 points to larboard and to reduce sail. Mr. Richards, have you noted the time? You must carefully note the time of everything." But, Dillon, what can the fellow be thinking of? Did he suppose we were engaged? Blind? However, this is not time to... "We'll board, of course, if only the Norwegians can hold out long enough. I hate firing into a galley in any event. I believe you may have all our pistols and cutlasses served out. Now, Mr. Marshall," he said, turning to the master, who was at his action station by the wheel, and who was now responsible for sailing the Sophie, "I want you to lay us alongside that damned moor. You may set the lower stunsails if she'll bear them." At this moment the gunner crept up the ladder. "Well, Mr. Day," said Jack, "I'm happy to see you on deck. Are you a little better?" "Much better, sir, I thank you," said Mr. Day, "thanks to the gentleman," nodding towards Stephen. "It worked," he said, directing his voice towards the taffrail. "I just thought I'd report as I was in my place, sir." "Glad of it. I'm very glad of it. This is a bit of luck, Master Gunner, I believe," said Jack. "Why, so it is, sir. It worked, Doctor. It worked, sir, like a maiden's dream." "So it is," said the gunner, looking complacently over the mile or so of sea at the daughter Engelbrechtstatter and the Corsair, that the Sophie, with all her guns warm, freshly loaded, run out, perfectly ready, her crew on tiptoe, and her decks cleared for action. "Here we were exercising," went on Jack, almost to himself, "and that impudent dog rode upwind on the far side and made a snatch at the cat. What can he be thinking of? And would be running off with her now if our good doctor hadn't brought us to our senses." "Never was such a doctor in my belief," said the gunner. "Now, I fancy I'd best get down into my magazine, sir. We've not all that powder filled, and I dare say you'll be calling for a tidy parcel." "My dear sir," said Jack to Stephen, measuring the Sophie's increasing speed and the distance that separated her from the embattled cat, in this state of triply intensified vitality, he could perfectly well calculate, talk to Stephen, and revolve a thousand shifting variables all at once. "My dear sir, do you choose to go below, or should you rather stay on deck? Perhaps it would divert you to go into the main top with a musket, along with the sharpshooters, and have a bang at the villains." "No, no, no," said Stephen. "I deprecate violence. My part is to heal rather than to kill. Or at least to kill with kindly intent. Pray let me take my place, my station in the cockpit." "I hoped you'd say that," said Jack, shaking him by the hand. "I hadn't liked to suggest it to my guest, however. It'll comfort the men amazingly, all of us indeed. Mr. Ricketts, show Dr. Matcher in the cockpit, and give the loblolly boy a hand with the chests." A sloop, with the depth of a mere 10 feet 10 inches, cannot rival a ship of the line for dank, airless obscurity below, but the Sophie did astonishingly well, and Stephen was obliged to call for another lantern to check and lay out his instruments and the meagre store of bandages, lint, tourniquets and pledgets. He was sitting there with Northcote's Marine Practice held close to the light, carefully reading, "Having divided the skin, order the same assistant to draw it up as much as possible, then cut through the flesh and bones circularly," when Jack came down. He had put on Hessian boots and his sword, and he was carrying a pair of pistols. "May I use the room next door?" asked Stephen, adding in Latin so that he might not be understood by the loblolly boy. It might discourage the patients were they to see me consulting my printed authorities. "Certainly, certainly," cried Jack, riding straight over the Latin. "Anything you like. I'll leave these with you. We shall board if ever we can come up with them, and then, you know, they might try to board us. There's no telling. These damned Algerines are usually crammed with men. Cutthroat dogs, every one of them," he added, laughing heartily and vanishing into the gloom. Jack had only been below a very short while, but by the time he returned to the quarter-deck, the situation had entirely changed. The Algerines were in command of the Cat. She was falling off before the northerly wind. They were setting her cross-jack, and it was clear that they hoped to get away with her. The galley lay in its own length away from her, on her starboard quarter. It lay there motionless on its oars, 14 great sweeps aside, headed directly towards the Sophie, with its huge lateen sails brailed up loosely to the yards. A long, low, slim vessel. Longer than the Sophie, but much slighter and narrower, obviously very fast, and obviously in enterprising hands. It had a singularly lethal, reptilian air. Its intention was clearly either to engage the Sophie, or at least to delay her until the prize crew should have run the Cat a mile or so down the wind towards the safety of the coming night. The distance was now a little over a quarter of a mile, and with a smooth, continuous flow, the relative positions were perpetually changing. The Cat's speed was increasing, and in 4 or 5 minutes she was a cable's length to the leeward of the galley, which still lay there on its oars. A fleeting cloud of smoke appeared in the galley's bows. A ball hummed overhead at about the level of the topmast cross-trees, followed in half a heartbeat by the deep boom of the gun that had fired it. "Note down the time, Mr. Richards," said Jack to the pale clerk. The nature of his pallor had changed, and his eyes were starting from his head. Jack hurried forward, just in time to see the flash of the galley's second gun. With an enormous smithy noise, the ball struck the fluke of the Sophie's best bower anchor, bent it half over, and glanced off into the sea far behind. "An 18-pounder," observed Jack to the boatswain, standing there at his post on the forecastle. "Maybe even a 24. Oh, for my long 12s," he added inwardly. The galley had no broadside, naturally, but mounted her guns fore and aft. In his glass, Jack could see that the forward battery consisted of 2 heavy guns, a smaller one and some swivels. And, of course, the Sophie would be exposed to their raking fire throughout her approach. The swivels were firing now. A high, sharp, cracking noise. Jack returned to the quarterdeck. "Silence fore and aft," he cried through the low, excited murmur. "Silence! Cast loose your guns. Level your guns. Out, Tompions. Run out your guns. Mr. Dillon, they are to be trained as far forward as possible. Mr. Babington, tell the gunner the next round will be chain." An 18-pound ball hit the Sophie's side between the larboard number 1 and 3 guns, sending in a shower of sharp-edged splintered wood, some pieces 2 feet long and heavy. It continued its course along the crowded deck, knocked down a marine, and struck against the mainmast, its force almost spent. A dismal, "Oh, oh, oh," showed that some of the splinters had done their work, and a moment later 2 seamen hurried by, carrying their mate below, leaving a trail of blood as they went. "Are those guns trained round?" cried Jack. "All hard round, sir," came the reply after a gasping pause. "Starboard broadside first. Fire as they bear, fire high, fire for the masts. Right, Mr. Marshall, over she goes. The Sophie yawed 45 degrees off her course, presenting quarter of her starboard side to the galley, which instantly sent another 18-pound ball into it amidships, just above the waterline, its deep, resonant impact surprising Stephen Maturin as he put a ligature round William Musgrave's spouting femoral artery, almost making him miss the loop. But now the Sophie's guns were bearing, and the starboard broadside went off on two successive rolls. The sea beyond the galley spat up in white plumes, and the Sophie's deck swirled with smoke, acrid, piercing gunpowder smoke. As the seventh gun fired, Jack cried, "Over again!" And the Sophie's head came round for the larboard broadside. The eddying cloud cleared under her lee. Jack saw the galley fire its whole forward battery and leap into motion under the power of its oars to avoid the Sophie's fire. The galley fired high on the upward roll, and one of its balls severed the main topmast stay and struck a great lump of wood from the cap. The lump, rebounding from the top, fell onto the gunner's head just as he put it up through the main hatchway. "Lively with those starboard guns," cried Jack. "Helm amidships." He meant to bring the sloop back onto the port tack, for if he could manage to get in another starboard broadside, he would catch the galley as it was moving across from left to right. A muffled roar from number four gun, and a terrible shrieking. In his haste, the sponger hadn't fully cleared the gun, and now the fresh charge had gone off in his face as he rammed it down. They dragged him clear, re-sponged, reloaded the gun and ran it up, but the whole manoeuvre had been too slow. The whole starboard battery had been too slow. The galley was round again. It could spin like a top with all those oars backing water, and it was speeding away to the southwest with the wind on its starboard quarter and its great lateen sails spread on either side. Set in hare's ears, as they say. The cat was now standing southeast. It was half a mile away already, and their courses were diverging fast. The yawing had taken a surprising amount of time, had lost a surprising amount of distance. "Port half a point," said Jack, standing on the lee rail and staring very hard at the galley, which was almost directly ahead of the Sophie, a little over 100 yards away and gaining. "T'gallant stunsails! Mr. Dillon, get a gun into the bows, if you please. We still have the 12-pounders' ring-bolts." As far as he could see, they had done the galley no harm. Firing low would have meant firing straight into benches packed tight with Christian rowers chained to the oars. Firing high, his head jerked sideways, his hat darted across the deck. A musket ball from the Corsair had nicked his ear. It was perfectly numb under his investigating hand, and it was pouring with blood. He stepped down from the rail, craning his head out sideways to bleed to windward, while his right hand sheltered his precious epaulette from the flow. "Killick!" he shouted, bending to keep his eyes on the galley under the taut arch of the square mainsail. "Bring me an old coat and another handkerchief." Throughout his changing, he gazed piercingly at the galley, which had fired twice with its single aftergun, both shots going a very little wide. "Lord, they run that 12-pounder in and out briskly," he reflected. The t'gallant studding sails were sheeted home. The Sophie's pace increased. Now she was gaining perceptibly. Jack was not the only one to notice this, and a cheer went up from the forecastle, running down the larboard side as the gun crews heard the news.
"The bow chaser is ready, sir," said James Dillon, smiling.
"Are you all right, sir?" he asked, seeing Jack's bloody hand and neck. "A scratch, nothing at all," said Jack. "What do you make of the galley?"
"We're gaining on her, sir," said Dillon.
And although he spoke quietly, there was an extraordinarily fierce exultation in his voice. He had been shockingly upset by Stephen's sudden appearance, and although his innumerable present duties had kept him from much consecutive thought, the whole of his mind, apart from its immediate forefront, was filled with unvoiced concern, distress,
and dark, incoherent nightmare shadows. He looked forward to the turmoil on the galley's deck with a wild longing. "She's spilling her wind," said Jack. "Look at that sly villain by the mainsheet. Take my glass." "No, sir. Surely not," said Dylan, angrily clapping the telescope shut. "Well," said Jack. "Well." A 12-pounder ball passed through the Sophie's starboard lower studding sails, two holes precisely behind each other, and hummed along 4 or 5 feet from them, a visible blur, just skimming the hammocks. "We could do with one or two of their gunners," observed Jack. "Masthead," he hailed. "Sir," came the distant voice. "What do you make of the sail to windward?" "Bearing up, sir, bearing up for the head of the convoy." Jack nodded. "Let the captains of the bow guns and the quarter gunners serve the chaser. I'll lay her myself." "Pring is dead, sir." "Another captain?"
"Make it, sir, Mr. Dillon."
He walked up, forward.
"Shall we catch him, sir?" asked a grizzled seaman, one of the big boarding party, with the pleasant friendliness of crisis.
"I hope so, Cundall, I hope so indeed," said Jack. "At least we shall have a bang at him." "That dog," he said to himself, staring along the dispart sight at the Algerine's deck. He felt the first beginning of the upward roll under the Sophie's forefoot, snapped the match down onto the touch-hole, heard the hiss and the shattering crash and the shriek of trucks as the gun recoiled.
"Huzzay! Huzzay!" roared the men on the forecastle.
It was no more than a hole in the galley's mainsail, about halfway up, but it was the first blow they'd managed to get home. Three more shots, and they heard one strike something metallic in the galley's stern.
"Carry on, Mr. Dillon," said Jack, straightening.
"Light along my glass, there." The sun was so low now that it was difficult to see as he stood balancing to the sea, shading his object glass with his far hand, and concentrating with all his power on two red-turbaned figures behind the galley's stern-chaser. A musketoon ball struck the Sophie's starboard knighthead, and he heard a seaman rip out a string of furious obscenity.
"John Lakey copped it something cruel," said a low voice close behind him. "In the bollocks."
The gun went off at his side, but before its smoke hid the galley from him, he'd made up his mind. The Algerine was, in fact, spilling his wind, starting his sheets so that his sails, apparently full, were not really drawing with their whole force. That was why the poor old fat, heavy, dirty-bottomed Sophie, labouring furiously and on the very edge of carrying everything away, was gaining slightly on the slim, deadly, fine-cut galley. The Algerine was leading him on. Could, in fact, run away at any moment. Why? To draw him far to the leeward of the cat, that was why. Together with the real possibility of dismasting him, raking him at leisure, being independent of the wind, and making a prize of the Sophie as well. To draw him to the leeward of the convoy, too, so that the sail to windward might snap up half a dozen of them. He glanced over his left shoulder at the cat. Even if she were to go about, they would still fetch her in one board, close-hauled, for she was a very slow creature, no t'gallants and, of course, no royals, far slower than the Sophie. But in a very little while on this course, and at this pace, he would never be able to reach her except by beating up, tack upon tack, with the darkness coming fast. It would not do. His duty was clear enough. The unwelcome choice, as usual. And this was the time for decision.
"Vast firing," he said as the gun ran in. "Starboard broadside, ready now. Sergeant Quinn, look to the small arms men. When we have a dead on the beam, aim for her cabin abaft the rowers' benches, right low. Fire at the word of command."
As he turned and ran back to the quarterdeck, he caught a look from James Dillon's powder-blackened face. A look, if not of anger or something worse, then at least of bitter contrariety.
"Hands to the braces," he called,
mentally dismissing that as something for another day. "Mr. Marshall, lay her for the cat." He heard the men's groan, a universal exhalation of disappointment, and said, "Hard over. We'll catch him unaware and give him something to remember the Sophie by," he added to himself, standing directly behind the starboard brass four-pounder. At this speed, the Sophie came round very fast. He crouched, half-bent, not breathing, all his being focused along the central gleam of brass and the turning seascape beyond it. The Sophie turned, turned. The galley's oars started into furious motion, churning up the sea, but it was too late. A tenth of a second before he had the galley dead on the beam, and just before the Sophie reached the middle of her downward roll, he cried, "Fire!" And the Sophie's broadside went off as crisply as a ship of the lines, together with every musket aboard. The smoke cleared, and a cheer went up, for there was a gaping hole in the galley's side, and the Moors were running to and fro in disorder and dismay. In his glass, Jack could see the stern chaser dismounted and several bodies lying on the deck. But the miracle hadn't happened. He had neither knocked her rudder away nor holed her disastrously below the waterline. However, there was no further trouble to be expected from her, he reflected, turning his attention from the galley to the cat. "Well, Doctor," he said, appearing in the cockpit, "how are you getting along?" "Tolerably well, I thank you. Has the battle begun again?" "Oh, no, that was only a shot across the cat's bows. The galley is hull down in the south-southwest, and Dillon has just taken a boat across to set the Norwegians free. The Moors have hung out a white shirt and called for quarter. The damn rogues!" "I am happy to hear it. It is really impossible to sew one's flaps neatly with the jarring of the guns. May I see your ear?" "It was only a passing flick. How are your patients?" "I believe I may answer for four or five of them. The man with the terrible incision in his thigh, they tell me it was a splinter of wood. Can this be true?" "Yes, indeed. A great piece of hard, sharp-edged oak flying through the air will cut you up amazingly. It often happens." "He's responded remarkably well. And I've patched up the poor fellow with the burn. Do you know that the rammer was actually thrust right through between the head of the biceps, just missing the ulnar nerve? But I cannot deal with the gunner down here, not in this light." "The gunner? What's amiss with the gunner? I thought you'd cured him." "So I had. Of the grossest self-induced costiveness it's ever been my privilege to see, caused by a frantic indulgence in Peruvian bark. Self-administered Peruvian bark. But this is a depressed cranial fracture, sir, and I must use the trephine. Here he lies. You notice the characteristic stertor, and I think he's safe until the morning. But as soon as the sun is up, I must have the top of his skull off with my little saw. You will see the gunner's brain, my dear sir," he added with a smile, "or at least his dura mater." Oh, dear," murmured Jack. Deep depression was settling on him. Anticlimax. Such a bloody little engagement for so little. Two good men killed. The gunner almost certainly dead. No man could survive having his brain open, that stood to reason. And the others might easily die too, they so often did. And if it hadn't been for that damned convoy, he might have had the galley. Two could play at that game. "Now what's to do?" he cried, as clamour broke out on deck. "They're carrying on very old-fashioned aboard the cats, sir," said the master, as Jack reached the quarter-deck in the twilight. The master came from some far northern part, Orkney, Shetland, and either that or a natural defect in his speech caused him to pronounce ER as AR, a peculiarity that grew more marked in time of stress. "It looks as though those infernal buggers were cutting their capers again, sir." "Put her alongside, Mr. Marshall. Boarders, come along with me." The Sophie braced round her yards to avoid any more damage, backed her foretopsail, and glided evenly along the cat's side. Jack reached out for the main channels on the Norwegian's high side and swung himself up through the wrecked boarding netting, followed by a grim and savage-looking band. Blood on the deck. Three bodies. Five ashy moors pressed against the roundhouse bulkhead under the protection of James Dillon, the dumb negro Alfred King with a boarder's axe in his hand. "Get those prisoners across," said Jack. "Stow them in the forehold. What's to do, Mr. Dillon?"
"I can't quite make him out, sir, but I think the prisoners must have attacked King between decks."
"Is that what happened, King?" The negro was still glaring about. His mates held his arms, and his answer might have meant anything. "Is that what happened, Williams?" asked Jack.
"Don't know, sir," said Williams, touching his hat and looking glassy.
"Is that what happened, Kelly?"
"Don't know, sir," said Kelly, with a knuckle to his forehead and the same look to a hair's breadth.
"Where's the cat's master, Mr. Dillon?"
"Sir, it seems the Moors tossed them all overboard."
"Good God!" cried Jack. Yet the thing was not uncommon. An angry noise behind him showed that the news had reached the Sophie. "Mr. Marshall," he called, going to the rail, "take care of these prisoners, will you? I will not have any foolery." He looked up and down the deck, up and down the rigging. Very little damage. "You will bring her into Colliery, Mr. Dillon," he said in a low voice, quite upset by the savagery of the thing. "Take what men you need." He returned to the Sophie, very grave, very grave. Yet he had scarcely reached his own quarter-deck before a minute, discreditable voice within said, "In that case, she's a prize, you know. Not just a rescue." He frowned it down, called for the boatswain, and began a tour of the brig, deciding the order of the more urgent repairs. She had suffered surprisingly for a short engagement in which not more than 50 shots had been exchanged. She was a floating example of what superior gunnery could do. The carpenter and two of his crew were over the side in cradles, trying to plug a hole very near the waterline.
"I can't rightly come at him, sir," said Mr. Lamb in answer to Jack's inquiry. "We half drowned, but we can't seem to bang an home, not on this tack."
"We'll put her about for you then, Mr. Lamb, but let me know the minute she's plugged." He glanced over the darkening sea at the cat, now taking her place in the convoy once more. Going about would mean travelling right away from the cat, and the cat had grown strangely dear to his heart. Loaded with spars, Stettin oak, Stockholm tar, cordage, continued that inner voice eagerly. She might easily fetch 2,000 or 3,000, even 4. "Yes, Mr. Watts, certainly," he said aloud. They climbed into the maintop and gazed at the injured cap.
"That was the bit that done poor Mr. Day's business for him," said the boatswain.
"So that was it. A devilish great lump indeed. But we must not give up hope. Dr. Maturin is going to do something prodigious clever with a saw as soon as there's light. He needs light for it. Something uncommonly skilful, I dare say."
"Oh, yes, I'm sure, sir," cried the boatswain warmly. "A very clever gentleman he must be, no question. The men are wonderfully pleased. How kind, they say, to saw off Ned Evans' leg so trim, and to sew up John Lakey's private parts so neat. As well as all the rest, he being, so to speak, on leave. A visitor-like."
"It is handsome," said Jack. "It is very handsome, I agree. We'll need a kind of gammoning here, Mr. Watt, until the carpenter can attend to the cap. Hawsers bowsed as tight as can be, and God help us if we have to strike topmasts." They saw to half a dozen other points, and Jack climbed down, paused to count his convoy, very close and orderly now after its fright, and went below. As he let himself sink onto the long cushioned locker, he found that he was in the act of saying, "Carry three,"
for his mind was busily working out 3/8 of £3,500. It had now fixed upon this sum as the worth of the daughter Engelbrecht's data. For 3/8, less one of them for the Admiral, was to be his share of the proceeds. Nor was his the only mind to be busy with figures by any means, for every other man on the Sophie's books was entitled to share. Dillon and the master, an 1/8 between them. The surgeon, if the Sophie had officially borne one on her books. Boatswain, carpenter and master's mates, another 1/8. Then the midshipmen, the inferior warrant officers and the marine sergeant, another 1/8. While the rest of the ship's company shared the remaining 1/4. And it was wonderful to see how briskly minds not given to abstract thought rattled these figures, these symbols up and down, coming out with the acting yeoman of the sheet share correct to the nearest farthing. He reached for a pencil to do the sum properly, felt ashamed, pushed it aside, hesitated, took it up again and wrote the figures very small, diagonally upon the corner of a leaf, thrusting the paper quickly from him at a knock on the door. It was the still moist carpenter, coming to report the shot holes plugged and no more than 18 inches of water in the well, which is less nor half what I expected with that nasty rough stroke the galley gave us, firing from so low down. He paused, giving Jack an odd, sideways-looking glance. "Well, that's capital, Mr. Lamb," said Jack after a moment. But the carpenter didn't stir. He stood there dripping on the painted sailcloth squares, making a little pool at last. Then he burst out, "Which, if it's true about the cat and the poor Norwegians dumped overboard, perhaps wounded too, which makes you right mad as being mere cruelty, what harm would they do if battened down? Howsoever, the warrant officers of the Sophie would wish the gentleman," jerking his head towards the night cabin, Stephen Maturin's temporary dwelling place, "cut in on their share fair dues as a mark of, as an acknowledgement of his conduct, considered very handsome by all hands." "If you please, sir," said Babington, "the cat's signalling." On the quarter-deck, Jack saw that Dillon had run up a motley hoist, obviously all the daughter Engelsbrecht data possessed, stating, among other things, that he had the plague aboard and that he was about to sail. "Hands to wear ship," he called. And when the Sophie had run down to within a cable's length of the convoy, he hailed, "Cat ahoy!" "Sir," came Dillon's voice over the intervening sea, "you will be pleased to hear the Norwegians are all safe." "What?" "The Norwegians are all safe." The two vessels came closer. "They hid in a secret place in the forepeak." "In the forepeak," went on Dillon. "Oh, fuck their forepeak," muttered the quartermaster at the wheel, for the Sophie was all ears, the very religious hush. "Full and by," cried Jack angrily, as the topsail shivered under the influence of the quartermaster's emotion. "Keep her full and by." "Full and by it is, sir." "And the master says," continued the distant voice, "could we send a surgeon aboard because one of his men hurt his toe hurrying down the ladder?" "Tell the master from me," cried Jack in a voice that reached almost to Calliope, his face purple with effort and furious indignation. "Tell the master that he can take his man's toe and fuck with it." He stumped below, £875 the poorer, and looking thoroughly sour and disagreeable. This, however, was not an expression that his features wore easily or for long. And when he stepped into the cutter to go aboard the Admiral in Genoa Roads, his face was quite restored to its natural cheerfulness. It was rather grave, of course, for the visit to the formidable Lord Keith, Admiral of the Blue and Commander-in-Chief in the Mediterranean, was no laughing matter. His gravity, as he sat there in the stern sheets, very carefully washed, shaved and dressed, affected his coxswain and the cutter's crew, and they rowed soberly along, keeping their eyes primly inboard. Yet even so they were going to reach the flagship too early, and Jack, looking at his watch, desired them to pull round the Audacious and lie on their oars. From here he could see the whole bay, with 5 ships of the line and 4 frigates 2 or 3 miles from the land, and inshore of them a swarm of gunboats and mortar vessels. They were steadily bombarding the noble city that rose steeply in a sweeping curve at the head of the bay, lying there in a cloud of smoke of their own making, lobbing bombs into the close-packed buildings on the far side of the distant mole. The boats were small in the distance. The houses, churches, and palaces were smaller still, though quite distinct in that sweet, transparent air, like toys. But the continuous rumbling of the fire and the deeper reply of the French artillery on shore was strangely close at hand, real and menacing. The necessary 10 minutes passed. The Sophie's cutter approached the flagship, and in answer to the hail of boat ahoy, the coxswain answered Sophie, meaning that her captain was aboard. Jack went up the side in due form, saluted the quarterdeck, shook hands with Captain Louis, and was shown to the Admiral's cabin. He had every reason to be pleased with himself. He had taken his convoy to Cagliari without loss, he had brought up another to Leghorn, and he was here at exactly the appointed time, in spite of calms off Monte Cristo. But for all that, he was remarkably nervous, and his mind was so full of Lord Keith that when he saw no admiral in that beautiful, great, light-filled cabin, but only a well-rounded young woman with her back to the window, he gaped like any carp. "Jackie, dear," said the young woman, "how beautiful you are, all dressed up. Let me put your neckcloth straight. La, Jackie, you look as frightened as if I were a Frenchman. Queenie! Old Queenie!" cried Jack, squeezing her and giving her a most affectionate smacking kiss. "God damn and blast! A legate corpus Sweeney!" cried a furious Scotch voice, and the Admiral walked in from the quarter gallery. Lord Keith was a tall, grey man with a fine leonine head, and his eyes shot blazing sparks of rage. "This is the young man I told you about, Admiral," said Queenie, patting poor, pale Jack's black stock into place and waving a ring at him. "I used to give him his bath and take him into my bed when he had bad dreams." This might not have been thought the very best possible recommendation to a newly married admiral of close on 60, but it seemed to answer. "Oh," said the Admiral. "Yes, I was forgetting. Forgive me. I have such a power of captains, and some of them are very mere rakes." "And some of them are very mere rakes," says he, piercing me through and through with that damned cold eye of his, said Jack, filling Stephen's glass and spreading himself comfortably along the locker. "And I was morally certain that he recognised me from the only 3 times we were in company, and each time worse than the last. The first was at the Cape in the old Rezzo when I was a midshipman. He was Captain Elphinston then. He came aboard just 2 minutes after Captain Douglas had turned me before the mast and said, 'What's yon wee snotty bairn a-greeting at?' Then Captain Douglas said, 'That wretched boy's a perfect young whoremonger. I've turned him before the mast to learn him his duty.'" "Is that a more convenient place to learn it?" said Stephen. "Well, it's easier for them to teach you deference," said Jack, smiling, "for they can seize you to a grating at the gangway and flog the liver and lights out of you with the cat. It means disrating a midshipman, degrading him so that he is no longer what we call a young gentleman, but a common sailor. He becomes a common sailor. He berths and messes with them, and he can be knocked about by anyone with a cane or a starter in his hand, as well as being flogged.
I never thought he'd really do it, although he'd threatened me with it often enough, for he was a friend of my father's, and I thought he had a kindness for me, which, indeed, he did. But, however, he carried it out, and there I was, turned before the mast. And he kept me there 6 months before rating me midshipman again. I was grateful to him in the end, because I came to understand the lower deck through and through. They were wonderfully kind to me on the whole, but at the time I bawled like a calf, wept like any girl. What made him take so decided a step? Oh, it was over a girl, a likely black girl called Sally, said Jack. She came off in a bumboat and I hid her in the cable tier. But Captain Douglas and I had disagreed about a good many other things. Obedience, mostly, and getting out of bed in the morning. And respect for the schoolmaster. We had a schoolmaster aboard, a drunken sot named Pitt, and a dish of tripe. Then the second time Lord Keith saw me was when I was fifth of the Hannibal, and our first lieutenant was that damn fool Carroll. If there's one thing I hate more than being on shore, it's being under the orders of a damn fool that's no seaman. He was so offensive, so designedly offensive, over a trivial little point of discipline, that I was obliged to ask him whether he'd like to meet me elsewhere. That was exactly what he wanted. He ran to the captain and said I'd called him out. Captain Newman said it was nonsense, but I must apologise. But I couldn't do that, for there was nothing to apologise about. I was in the right, you see. So there I was, hauled up in front of half a dozen post-captains and two admirals. Lord Keith was one of the admirals. What happened? Petulance. I was officially reprimanded for petulance. Then the third time... Oh, but I'll not go into details, said Jack. It's a very curious thing, you know, he went on, gazing out of the stern window with a look of mild, ingenuous wonder. A prodigious curious thing. But there cannot be many men who are both damned fools and no seamen who reach post rank in the Royal Navy. Men with no interest, I mean, of course. And yet it so happens that I've served under no less than two of them. I really thought I was dished that time. Career finished, cut down. Alas, poor Borwick. I spent 8 months on shore, as melancholy as that chap in the play, going up to town whenever I could afford it, which wasn't often, and hanging about that damned waiting room in the Admiralty. I really thought I should never get to sea again, a half-pay lieutenant for the rest of my life. If it hadn't been for my fiddle and fox-hunting when I could get a horse, I think I should have hanged myself. That Christmas was the last time I saw Queenie, I believe, apart from just once in London. Is she an aunt, a cousin? No connection at all. But we were almost brought up together, or rather, she almost brought me up. I always remember her as a great girl, not a child at all. Though to be sure, there can't be 10 years between us. Such a dear, kind creature. They had Damplow, the next house to ours. They were almost in our park. And after my mother died, I dare say I spent as much time there as I did at home. More, he said reflectively, gazing up at the telltale compass overhead. You know Dr. Johnson? Dictionary Johnson? Certainly, cried Stephen, looking strange. The most respectable, the most amiable of the moderns. I disagree with all he says, except when he speaks of Ireland, yet I honour him. And for his life of savage, I love him. What is more, he occupied the most vivid dream I ever had in my life not a week ago. How strange that you should mention him today. Yes, ain't it? He was a great friend of theirs until their mother ran off and married an Italian, a papist. Queenie was wonderfully upset at having a papist to her father-in-law, as you may imagine. Not that she ever saw him, however. Anything but a papist, says she. I should rather have had Black Frank 1,000 times, I declare. So we burnt 13 guys in a row that year, It must have been 83 or 84, not long after the Battle of the Saints. After that, they settled at Damplow more or less for good. The girls, I mean. And their old she-cousin. Dear Queenie. I believe I spoke of her before, didn't I? She taught me mathematics.
I believe you did.
A Hebrew scholar, if I do not mistake. Exactly so. Conic sections and the Pentateuch came as easy as kiss my hand to her. Dear Queenie. I thought she was to be an old maid, though she was so pretty. For how could any man make up to a girl that knows Hebrew? It seemed a sad pity. Anyone so sweet-tempered should have a prodigious great family of children. But, however, here she is, married to the Admiral, so it all ends happy. Yet, you know, he's amazingly ancient. Grey-haired, rising 60, I dare say. Do you think, as a physician... I mean, is it possible...
Possibilissima.
Eh?
Possibile la cose naturale,
sang Stephen in a harsh, creaking tone, quite unlike his speaking voice, which was not disagreeable.
Esse Susanna vuol possibilissima.
Discordantly, but near enough to Figaro to be recognised. Really? Really? Said Jack with intense interest. Then, after a pause for reflection, we might try that as a duetto. Improvising. She joined him at Leghorn, and there I was, thinking it was my own merit, recognised at last, and honourable wounds, laughing heartily, that had won me my promotion, whereas I make no doubt that it was all dear Queenie, do you see? But I haven't told you the best, and this I certainly owe to her. We are to have a 6 weeks' cruise down the French and Spanish coast as far as Cape Nau. I? Well, that'd be good. Yes, yes, very good. No more convoy duty, you understand. No more being tied to a lubberly parcel of sneaking rogues, merchants creeping up and down the sea. The French and the Spaniards, their trade, their harbours, their supplies. These are to be our objects. Lord Keith was very earnest about the great importance of destroying their commerce. He was very particular about it indeed. As important as your great fleet actions, says he, and so very much more profitable. The Admiral took me aside and dwelt upon it at length. He's a most acute, far-sighted commander. Not a Nelson, of course, but quite out of the ordinary. I'm glad Queenie has him. And we're under no one's orders, which is so delightful. No bald-pated pantaloon to say, Jack Aubrey, you proceed to Leghorn with these hogs for the fleet, making it quite impossible even to hope for a prize. Prize money! He cried, smiling and slapping his thigh, and the marine sentry outside the door, who had been listening intently, wagged his head and smiled too. Are you very much attached to money? Asked Stephen. I love it passionately, said Jack, with truth ringing clear in his voice. I've always been poor, and I long to be rich.
That's right, said the marine.
My dear old father was always poor too, went on Jack, but as open-handed as a summer's day. He gave me £50 a year allowance when I was a midshipman, which was uncommon handsome in those days. Or would have been, had he ever managed to persuade Mr. Hoare to pay it after the first quarter. Lord, how I suffered in the old rezzo. Mess bills, laundry, growing out of my uniforms. Of course I love money. But I think we should be getting underway. There's two bells striking. Jack and Stephen were to be the gunroom's guests, to taste the sucking pig bought at Leghorn. James Dillon was there to bid them welcome, together with the master, the purser, and Mowat, as they plunged into the gloom. The gun room had no stern windows, no sash ports, only a scrap of skylight right forward. For although the peculiarity of the sofa's construction made for a very comfortable captain's cabin, luxurious indeed if only the captain's legs had been sawn off a little above the knee, unencumbered with the usual guns, it meant that the gun room lay on a lower level than the spar deck and reposed upon a kind of shelf, not unlike an orlop. Dinner was rather a stiff, formal entertainment to begin with, although it was lit by a splendid Byzantine silver hanging lamp taken by Dillon out of a Turkish galley, and although it was lubricated by uncommonly good wine, for Dillon was well-to-do, even wealthy by naval standards. Everyone was unnaturally well-behaved. Jack was to give the tone, as he knew very well. It was expected of him, and it was his privilege. But this kind of deference, this attentive listening to every remark of his, required the words he uttered to be worth the attention they excited. A wearing state of affairs for a man accustomed to ordinary human conversation, with its perpetual interruption, contradiction, and plain disregard. Here, everything he said was right. And presently his spirits began to sink under the burden. Marshall and Purser Ricketts sat mum, saying please and thank you, eating with dreadful precision. Young Mowat, a fellow guest, was altogether silent, of course. Dillon worked away at the small talk, but Stephen Maturin was sunk deep in a reverie. It was the pig that saved this melancholy feast. Impelled by a trip on the part of the steward that coincided with a sudden lurch on the part of the Sophie, it left its dish at the door of the gun room and shot into Mowat's lap. In the subsequent roaring and hullabaloo, everyone grew human again, remaining natural long enough for Jack to reach the point he'd been looking forward to since the beginning of dinner. "Well, gentlemen," he said, after they had drunk the King's health, "I have news that will please you, I believe. Though I must ask Mr. Dillon's indulgence for speaking of a service matter at this table. The Admiral gives us a cruise on our own, down to Cape Nau. And I have prevailed upon Dr. Maturin to stay aboard, to sew us up when the violence of the King's enemies happens to tear us apart." "Huzzay! Well done! Hear, hear! Topping news! Good! Hear him!" they cried, all more or less together. And they looked so pleased. There was so much candid friendliness on their faces that Stephen was intensely moved. "Lord Keith was delighted when I told him," Jack went on. "Said he envied us extremely, had no position in the flagship. Was amazed when I told him of the gunner's brains. Called for his spyglass to look at Mr. Day taking the sun on deck, and wrote out the doctor's order in his own hand, which is something I have never heard of in the service before. Nor had anyone there present. The order had to be wetted. 3 bottles of port, there, Killick. Bumpers all round." And while Stephen sat looking modestly down at the table, they all stood up, crouching their heads under the beams, and sang, "Huzzay, huzzay, huzzay! Huzzay, huzzay, huzzay! Huzzay, huzzay, huzzay! Huzzay!" "There is only one thing I do not care for, however," he said as the order was passed reverently round the table, "and that is this foolish insistence upon the word surgeon. Do hereby appoint you surgeon. Take upon you the employment of surgeon, together with such allowance for wages and victuals for yourself as is usual for the surgeon of the said sloop. It is a false description, and a false description is anathema to the philosophic mind." "I am sure it is anathema to the philosophic mind," said James Dillon, "but the naval mind fairly revels in it, so it does. Take that word sloop, for example." "Yes, said Stephen, narrowing his eyes through the haze of port, then trying to remember the definitions he'd heard. "Why, now, a sloop, as you know, is properly a one-masted vessel with a fore-and-aft rig, but in the Navy a sloop may be ship-rigged. She may have three masts." "Or take the Sophie," cried the master, anxious to bring his crumb of comfort. "She's rightly a brig, you know, Doctor, with her two masts." He held up two fingers, in case a landman might not fully comprehend so great a number. "But the minute Captain Aubrey sets foot in her, why, she too becomes a sloop, for a brig is a lieutenant's command." "Or take me," said Jack. "I'm called Captain, but really I'm only a master and commander." "Or the place where the men sleep, just forward," said the purser, pointing. "Rightly speaking, an official, 'tis the gun deck, though there's never a gun on it. We call it the spar deck, though there's no spars neither. But some say the gun deck still, and call the right gun deck the upper deck. Or take this brig, which is no true brig at all, not with her square mainsail, but rather a sort of snow or a hermaphrodite." "No, no, my dear sir," said James Dillon. "Never let a mere word grieve your heart. We have nominal captain servants who are in fact midshipmen. We have nominal able seamen on our books who are scarcely breeched. They're 1,000 miles away and still at school. We swear we've not shifted any backstays when we shift them continually. And we take many other oaths that nobody believes. No, no. You may call yourself what you please so long as you do your duty. The Navy speaks in symbols, and you may suit what meaning you choose to the words."